1945, as the Russians were approaching von Braun's rocket headquarters, he and 115 other of his Nazi rocket scientists escaped with valuable papers and traveled west in Germany until they could turn themselves into the Allied armies on the west. Later the same year, von Braun and the 115 other German scientists were removed to Fort Bliss, Texas, where they remained until 1950. In 1950, von Braun and the others were moved onto the old Redstone Arsenal in Huntsville, Alabama, where they remain to this date. Von Braun, immediately upon arriving in the United States, made close personal friends with J. Edgar Hoover and Lyndon B. Johnson, and the relationship remained close, with von Braun working with Hoover in security in the Tennessee Valley Authority and the Redstone Arsenal, and later, beginning in 1958, they worked together in the security of the National Space Agency. 1958 was the year that Lyndon Johnson, as majority leader of the Senate, helped to push through the National Space Act, and later, when he became vice president, he was made chairman of the National Space Committee. Worth noting that the Tennessee Valley Authority was basically an independent federal agency set up by Roosevelt to govern the Tennessee Valley. It had its own police force, and this police force began working with J. Edgar Hoover in Division 5 of the FBI, and in turn was grafted onto something which Torbett identifies as the Defense Industrial Security Command, basically a sort of private, federal police force put together by the munitions makers to police their agency. Okay, and that's how the Tennessee Valley Authority came to be identified with Division 5 of FBI, and where that comes into this whole picture here. By the way, Huntsville, Alabama is in the Tennessee Valley is part under TVA jurisdiction. Okay, now remember Ferenc Nagy, the ex-Hungarian prime minister, board member of Centro Mondiale Commerciale, Permindex president we talked about a while ago. He comes in here. Ferenc Nagy, ex-Hungarian prime minister, and Albert Alexander Osborne, alias John H. Bowen, B-O-W-E-N, the overseer of the assassins in Mexico, both reported consistently to the Muscle Shoals, Huntsville, Alabama area, and there is substantial evidence that their contact in this area was Wernher von Braun. The general historical material that I cited, Torbett got from Collier's Encyclopedia. The rest of the information comes from the following. New Orleans District Attorney Records, Volume 25 of the Warren Commission Testimony and Exhibits, page 35 at Sequoia, page 35 and following pages, and the statements of A.D. Mueller in Memphis, Tennessee. Mueller is M-U-E-L-L-E-R. Continuing here with Copeland's account. Another of the Nazi space scientists who worked with the cabal was Walter Dornberger, last name D-O-R-N-B-E-R-G-E-R. He had been the commanding officer of Wernher von Braun while both were working for Adolf Hitler's rocket program. During the time period involved, Walter Dornberger was a directing officer in the Bell Aerospace Corporation, along with Fred Korth, K-O-R-T-H. Fred Korth, by the way, was former Secretary of the Navy, or I guess Under Secretary of the Navy. The former Nazi rocket officer was directly in charge of the assignment of Michael Payne to Bell Helicopter Corporation, a subsidiary in Fort Worth, Texas. Payne's assignment was to provide a place for Marina Oswald during the approximately 8 months prior to November 22, 1963. He provided for Marina to live with his wife, Ruth, in Irving, Texas. Ray Krystinik, K-R-Y-S-T-I-N-I-K, testified to the Warren Commission that Michael Payne, immediately after Lee Oswald was captured at the theater, said, quote, "The stupid blank, he was not even supposed to have a gun," unquote. Okay, it might be worthwhile in sort of interrupting here to go into a little bit of discussion of the background of Messrs. Von Braun and Dornberger. Now, both, it has frequently been cited by many historians, both men have been cited as sort of, in a sense, victims of the Third Reich. In other words, it has been maintained that both men were, in essence, technicians or engineers who were coerced into helping the nasty old Hitler perform, launch his weapon systems and build them and so forth. This has been hotly debated by a lot of people since. Many people have maintained that, in fact, they were virulent Nazis. It's worth taking note of the conditions that the V-1 and V-2 were built under. Essentially, like virtually all Third Reich industrial projects, they used slave labor. People were literally worked to death. They were worked under abysmal conditions, and they weren't fed, and eventually they all died. The slave labor Peine Mundo was where the rockets were built at first. That was bombed by the Allies in 43. Then the Nazi rocket center was moved to the Harz Mountains. Now, in the Harz Mountains, there was an underground series of tunnels dug, and this served as the labor depot, I guess you might call it, for the construction of the V-1s, V-2s, and other Nazi rocket weapons. Now, initially, this camp, by the way, was nicknamed, well, it was called, formerly called Dora, D-O-R-A, just like a woman's name. Initially, it was an annex of Buchenwald, one of the most notorious concentration camps. Laborers were taken from Buchenwald and sent to Dora. And Dora was one of the most infamous of all concentration camps. The workers there, well, they basically had to dig all of the facilities out from solid rock with no tools whatsoever. They weren't fed. They had no sanitary facilities. And every few hours, several of the inmates were hung by a piece of piano wire through the back of their neck, and they were allowed to hang from the roof of the catacombs until basically their bodies would fall on the concrete floor. This is sort of work incentive to keep their buddies going. So these are the kinds of conditions that were in Dora. And keep in mind also now that Walter Dornberger is the guy who assigns Michael Payne to Bell Helicopter. Michael Payne was in charge of helicopter development for Bell Aerospace. And that's worth keeping in mind, of course. We talked about the Vietnam connections to the war last week. Bell Helicopter didn't do too bad during the Vietnam War.
Okay, now on the subject of both Wernher von Braun and Walter K. Dornberger, a couple of things to touch on real quickly here. The first is from a book called Project Paperclip, subtitled German Scientists and the Cold War, by Clarence G. Lasby. This book was originally copyrighted in 1971, although in the edition that we have, which is the Athenaeum Press paperback edition, was published in 1975. Okay, from Project Paperclip, which again, just to touch back on it, because I know it gets kind of confusing, as Dave mentioned, Project Paperclip was the government's nomenclature, to use that word again, for the project that brought the German rocket scientists into the United States and put them to work for the United States. Okay, reading from Lasby's Project Paperclip. For the most part, the Americans had their way over the division of the rocket experts, this means right after the war, simply because they had them in custody. After all the, quote, shouting and bloodshed, Colonel Toftoy chose the 127 he wanted. The British did win a token victory. Over the protestations of von Braun, they convinced their ally, the U.S., to relinquish any claim on General Dornberger. They, the British, considered him, quote, a menace of the first order, who deserved to be, quote, left on the dust heap. As one Englishman explained to his American friend, the military commander of Peenemünde, Dornberger, quote, will ever have in mind the desirability of returning to a resurrected Reich, carrying with him the knowledge accumulated by the German rocketeers while working under Allied patronage. The Americans were not anxious to import the enemy general. After listening to monitored conversations between Dornberger and fellow inmates of detention centers, they concluded he had, quote, an untrustworthy attitude in seeking to turn ally against ally, and that he would be, quote, a source of irritation and future unrest among the Germans if he were sent to America. One American general quipped that, quote, we may trade him to the Russians for a dish of caviar. But His Majesty's government, meaning Britain, had plans of their own. They imprisoned him for 2 years, hoping to find some legal basis to place him in the dock at Nuremberg. Only upon his release in 1947 was Dornberger free to accept a contract under Project Paperclip, which led eventually to the directorship of research and development at the Bell Aircraft Company. So, here's Walter K. Dornberger, who the British were desperately trying to get into the war crimes trials at Nuremberg, who eventually wound up, as we mentioned earlier, not only working in the U.S. space program, working for Bell Aerospace and Bell Helicopter subsidiarily, however you'd say that, but again having direct influence over the movement of Michael Payne, who the Payne family figured again prominently in the life of Lee Harvey Oswald.
Again, that information from probably the best single authoritative work on Project Paperclip. It's called, again, Project Paperclip by Clarence G. Lasby, L-A-S-B-Y, published in softcover by the Athenaeum Press in 71.
Okay, now, let's just hop along here, and we're going to look at another book. This is the book Dora, and Dave mentioned that Dora is the name of the concentration camp that became an adjunct to the Nazi rocket program's second base after Peenemünde was bombed by the Allies, and their second rocket camp was in the Harz Mountains of Germany, and Dora was a prison camp literally built out of the solid rock of the Harz Mountains. This book Dora is written by Jean Michel, M-I-C-H-E-L, who himself was a prisoner, a French prisoner of war in the camp Dora, and it's written in association with Louis Nucera, N-U-C-E-R-A, translated by Jennifer Kidd. And this book was published by Holt, Reinhardt, and Winston, copyright 1975, English translation copyright 79. Okay, so this chapter deals with Wernher von Braun, and leading off the chapter is a short poem by a gentleman by the name of Joe Yostin. Now, Joe Yostin, if you were listening carefully, and I'm sure you were, we mentioned leading off the show tonight, Joe Yostin was a prominent early critic of the Warren Commission, who the CIA released, and where they got them has never quite been explained either, but the CIA released raw Gestapo memos painting Joe Yostin, who at the time had lived in Germany when the Gestapo got this information on him, as a member of the German Communist Party. And, of course, the German Communist Party was basically destroyed by the Nazis, just thoroughly eradicated. And the CIA used this to attempt to smear Joe Yostin, even going so far as to have it read into the congressional record. Raw Gestapo memos read into the congressional record to smear a critic of the Warren Commission. Well, this is a short poem by Joe Yostin, which was published in The Nation magazine leading off this chapter. And it says, "If you have a taste for collective massacre, but your own skin is precious to you, become a scientist, my son. Today, that is the only way to commit murder with impunity. Nowadays, to be a warmongering politician is not a safe profession. If you lose, they will hang you. If you are a defeated general, you will go to prison. But if you are a scientist, you will be honored, whichever side you are on. Your enemies will covet you. They will fight among themselves to have you, without giving a thought to the number of their compatriots you might have killed." Going on with Michel's book, Dora, in his memoirs, Albert Speer describes his visit to the extensive underground installations where the V-2 was to be produced. And I should just insert, this V-2 was being produced under the ministrations of Walter K. Dornberger and Wernher von Braun. Quote, this is Speer's description. Speer, by the way, was the architectural minister and later the master of the Third Reich in its final days.
He was in charge of their armaments program.
Armaments program, thank you. And Speer himself is probably was for a long time the most famous living member of the Reich and is stuck in prison for quite some time. In his memoirs, Albert Speer describes his visit to the extensive underground installations where the V-2 was to be produced. In enormous long halls, prisoners were busy setting up machinery and shifting plumbing. Expressionlessly, they looked right through me, mechanically removing their prisoners' caps of blue twill until our group had passed them. The conditions for these prisoners were in fact barbarous, and a sense of profound involvement and personal guilt seizes me whenever I think of them. The official report is even more explicit. On the morning of 10th December, the minister went to inspect a new plant in the Harz Mountains. Carrying out this tremendous mission drew on the leader's last reserves of strength. Some of the men were so affected that they had to be forcibly sent off on vacation to restore their nerves. We might mention here that these are a variety of people who might not be conceived of as having especially weak nerves. Dave, who was there besides Speer?
I don't actually know which leaders were present. I've never seen an exact enumeration, but none of the leaders of the Third Reich were exactly known as sort of limp-wristed aesthetes.
A bunch of softies. Okay, going on, it says, General Walter Dornberger, Professor Wernher von Braun, and the Pena Munda scientists must have had steadier nerves and stronger stomachs. From their pens can be found no allusions to the deportation camps or any concentration camp workforce. It was left to Speer, judged and condemned at Nuremberg, to reveal his feelings, and with a sentimentality that came rather too late. The conquerors of space were not about to tarnish their glory with such sordid details.
Well, worth noting, too, that when Dora had such a bad reputation, not only did a mere visit to this camp unnerve the core leadership of the Third Reich, but at Buchenwald, which was itself one of the most notorious of all the Nazi concentration camps, at Buchenwald, and by the way, Jean Michel was an inmate both at Buchenwald and Dora, the word was, don't get sent to Dora. In other words, the word at Buchenwald was, you go to Dora, you've had it. And Buchenwald was one tough nut to crack, by all accounts.
That's right. So, by all accounts, not to make light of it, but even the people in Buchenwald and other concentration camps knew that going to Dora was not a day at the beach. And as we mentioned, the Nazi leaders themselves, Speer among them, had to be forcibly sent on vacation after seeing the horrors of Dora that was, again, in part controlled by Dornberger and von Braun.
Okay, now, recall the metaphor that we've used so often of the Kennedy assassination as the waste of an hourglass. We're going to observe some of the sands and how they trickle through this particular hourglass and passing through this. Continuing here with Nomenclature of an Assassination Cabal by David Copeland, operating under the pen name of William Torbett. Von Braun first met Clay Shaw in 1945 when he, Walter Dornberger, and about 150 other Nazi rocket scientists abandoned Peenemünde and traveled south to join the American forces in Germany close to the French border. The slight error here, they did not leave Peenemünde, they left the Harz Mountains. Peenemünde was destroyed at this point. The Nazis were brought to the Deputy Chief of Staff's headquarters, where Major Clay Shaw was aide-de-camp to General Charles O. Thrasher, T-H-R-A-S-H-E-R, Deputy Chief, European Theater of Operations. Von Braun, Dornberger, and Shaw maintained the relationship over the years through their mutual connection with the Defense Industrial Security Command, an operational arm of the Counter-Espionage Division of the FBI. The sources for that information, Appointment on the Moon by Richard Lewis, Who's Who in the South and Southwest, 1963 and 64, and New Orleans District Attorney Files, and the General Staff Files of the U.S. Army European Command, OUISE section. Continuing. Ordnance Colonel Holgar N. Toftoy, T-O-F-T-O-Y, which you heard reference to in the passage Nip read you just a second ago from Project Paperclip. Ordnance Colonel Holgar N. Toftoy was in charge of the Nazi scientists, and Clay Shaw in the European Command section gave firm assistance to the transfer of 127 of them to the United States after they had spent about 5 months with the command in Europe. Same sources as the last one, that is to say, Appointment on the Moon, New Orleans District Attorney Records, General Staff Files, U.S. Army European Command, OUISE section. In the transfer of the Nazi rocket scientists, the services of Adolf Hitler's intelligence agency was used extensively, and Shaw, von Braun, Dornberger, and the others began a very close association with the Nazi agency and its commander. The Bundesnachrichtendienst, better known as the Federal Intelligence Agency or FIA, is largely dependent upon the CIA, which subsidizes and controls it. In 1963 was Reinhard Gehlen, a former ex-Nazi general recuperated in August of 1945 by Alan Dulles, who at the time headed the OSS in Switzerland and was in charge of American intelligence activities in occupied Germany. The Solidarists and Gehlen had conceived of the idea of the Vlasov Army, unquote, which were Russian anti-communist troops, and Gehlen was given the responsibility for the underground that continued to operate behind communist lines until 1950. So basically, guerrilla armies put together by Hitler operated behind the so-called Iron Curtain until at least 1950. I've seen the date put as late as 52 under CIA auspices. Keep in mind, these were former Third Reich combatants. So in essence, there was a continuation of combat in the East. In Poland, Gehlen's guerrillas on March 28, 1947, murdered General Karol Spierczynski, Vice Minister of Defense, who under the name of Walter had commanded the 14th International Brigade in Spain and who served as the model for one of the characters in Hemingway's For Whom the Bell Tolls. Okay, that basically is most... Well, we read one more paragraph. Gehlen developed his network under the cover of a firm known as the Economic Association for the Development of South Germany. He employed former members of the Gestapo, such as Bemelberg, his intelligence chief in Berlin, and Franz Alfred Sieks, former SS general and one of Eichmann's subordinates, who was put in charge of Gehlen's contacts in West Europe. So again, through the waste of the hourglass, Clay Shaw, an OSS officer, works with the Nazi rocket scientists and plays a close role in bringing them to the United States, maintains contact with them. They, in turn, meet LBJ at around this same time period, maintain that association. And the Gehlen organization works closely with the transfer of the rocket scientists and is itself brought to the United States. By the way, one spelling here, Spierczynski, the model for the Hemingway character is S-W-I-E-R-C-Z-E-N-S-K-I.
Okay. I believe that for this section of the show, at least as far as the John F. Kennedy information that we have, we are going to put a halt to that for this evening because we've still got a lot more we want to talk about regarding other assassinations. We're going to be talking about here is basically an overall picture which we've been trying to paint as much as possible by filling people in on some of the I guess what you could call the context of what was going on not only in the world at large, which people at least know to a degree or at least are familiar with, but in terms of the clandestine world, the forces at play, the shadow world of international fascism and all that kind of stuff, which, you know, it becomes a cliche, but it was very much the case and still is, that there are just literally thousands of people with money and connections and involved in moving guns and weaponry and in many cases drugs in and out of countries for profit and for political gain. and in touch in many places on the intelligence communities and the governments of countries such as ours. And this is where a lot of these things come into play. Now, many times the these situations, the covert actuating of history, I suppose you could say, is balked at in certain instances by mostly by public resistance, and many times public resistance coalesces behind a leader or a group of leaders or a political movement of some kind that will make it difficult for people who are trying to manipulate history for their own ends or just manipulate political fact for their own ends. Again, to touch back on the reference, since we have been talking about the Nazis tonight, to touch back on the Nazis and the way the Nazis came to power, we mentioned the Reichstag fire. Well, the Reichstag fire was not the only way. The Reichstag fire was, in fact, one of the final catalysts that enabled the Nazis to finalize and seal their power in Germany by a full-scale extermination of their enemies. However, basically, first, the position had to arise in Germany where the Nazis could take power, and this happened in a variety of ways. In Germany at the end of World War I, Germany as a country was literally decimated. The economy was virtually gone. Inflation was running, you know, at 1,000% in some places. And of course, in times like this, society goes through great polarization. However, there were it was not strictly a left-right situation in Germany, which is how it has been painted by some people, that there was the Communist Party and there was the Nazi Party, and everybody had to make their choice between them. This is not true. As a matter of fact, some of the people who came out of World War I politically with the best standing were the middle of the road, the liberal German politicians. Came out because the military had been so thoroughly discredited in many ways, or at least the military establishment, not necessarily the German army itself, for which there was a great deal of respect in Germany, but the military establishment in terms of the general staff, the people, the pan-Germanist militarists who had essentially been planning World War I since back in the late 1800s as the first step to leading Germany to take its rightful place as master of the world. Well, there was a group called the FEMA, which we have talked about before, spelled F-E-H-M-E, and the FEMA was a group consisting of several members of the German general staff and high-ranking industrialists in Germany at the end of World War I, who felt that it was going to be their responsibility, and the responsibility was going to devolve on them to rebuild Germany from the ashes and make her a world power yet again, despite the fact that she was reeling from her losses during World War I. And the German general staff, the military machine of Germany, and these various right-wing industrialists, basically, among other things, while applying political and propaganda pressure on the people to reject the center, the left, and all other non-right-wing modes of conduct, also engaged in a campaign of systematic assassination and elimination of the liberal and liberal-left leadership of Germany.
Alrighty, now, the FEMA was actually a revival of an old organization, sort of like the Klan, that had been used by the Junkers, the landowners of Germany, to sort of keep the peasants in their place. It was revived for use by the underground military organizations, the extensions of the German general staff that existed in Germany. These generally go under a couple of names. They're known as the Freikorps or Free Corps, also the Black Reichswehr. The Reichswehr was the name of the German army in World War I, and the so-called underground organization, well, the so-called, well, the Freikorps, the Free Corps, were actually underground German army units.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Also, the Black Hundreds is a term that one hears.
Black Hundreds is that was the term applied to the Tsarist pogromists in Russia.
Ah, you're right. Okay,
but there was a lot of Black Hundreds wound up in the FEMA and the Freikorps because
right.
Many of them fled
That's
west
right.
following the Bolshevik Revolution. But Black Hundreds were Tsarist pogromists.
That's right.
The underground military killing groups in Germany were called alternately. Well, they were known as the FEMIC, FEMA, and the FEMIC assassination units of the Freikorps or Free Corps and Black Reichswehr. Now, these organizations systematically eliminated the democratic leadership of Weimar Germany through a wave of assassinations. And the liaison officer between the German General Staff and the Freikorps, the man actually in charge of running the Freikorps and Black Reichswehr units for the General Staff, was an undercover German Army agent, basically a Reichswehr agent named Ernst Röhm, last name R-O-E-H-M. And he was reporting to a general named General von Epp, last name E-P-P. Now, Adolf Hitler at the time, his real name was Adolf Schickelgruber. Adolf Hitler was the most commonly used of several intelligence agencies that he was known to use. Now, because of the hard conditions brought on by World War I and none of the economic conditions brought on by the British blockade in World War I, but also the certain facing the certain prospect of death in the trenches, the German people revolted. They basically, like the Russian people, they hoisted the red flag. Unlike in Russia, there was a large middle class in Germany which did not support the revolution, sided with the, quote, establishment, unquote, in other words, the general staff and the big industrialists, and as a result, the revolution failed. In other words, eventually the revolution was put down and its leaders were dispensed with. Now, Adolf Schickelgruber, operating under his most commonly used alias of Adolf Hitler, infiltrated the unsuccessful German revolution in the Munich area, and after it was suppressed, he fingered all of its leaders who were shot. He next, along with Ernst Röhm and a fellow named Dietrich Eckert, two other German Army agents, undercover German Army agents named Rudolf Hess and Alfred Rosenberg, which is where your Black Hundreds come in. Rosenberg was a Baltic white Russian. They were infiltrated into a defunct German political party at the time when Hitler joined it. This defunct party had something like 7 members, and they met in a beer hall and kept their dues in a cigar box. This organization, a whole bunch of undercover German Army agents were Reichswehr agents, including Schickelgruber alias Hitler, were infiltrated into this organization, which was then renamed the NSDAP, the German National Socialist Workers' Party, or the Nazi Party. And the Nazi Party became a vehicle for the introduction of the German army into German civilian society in order to basically drive it to the right, to systematically eliminate not only communist elements but democratic elements as well. And this organization, this ostensibly a political party, in reality simply an extension of the German army, that was the main vehicle for nationalism and anti-Semitic propaganda by the German army, so that you had whole units of supposedly demobilized German troops, demobilized at the end of World War I, being infiltrated into the Nazi party and then turned out sometimes up to complete company strength in the uniform of the SA, the Sturmabteilung, the stormtroopers, whose head was Ernst Röhm, the same fellow who was the liaison between General von Epp and the Freikorps. And so this is what the German army was. It was a vehicle for It was a vehicle for the introduction of the German army into civilian society for the purposes of political reaction, basically.
Now, we're going to draw some parallels here between the actions of the FEMA and other similar groups in similar situations, and at least the symptoms, and in many cases actually the causes, of some of the things that we've been talking about, most notably the John F. Kennedy assassination and the other assassinations and attempted assassinations that we're going to talk about, as far as the systematic militarization of American domestic and foreign policy. Now, one last thing that I should mention real quickly, which is, if people out there listen to something like the FEMA and say, well, what is this, you know, wacky 1918 Nazi stuff, I would urge you folks to go and read your local newspapers, because this has currently been done at the behest of the CIA all over Latin and Central America, just to name one place right now. And this is exactly the same thing that is going on with the death squads of Latin America at this very moment. These are all military and police personnel who are going out ostensibly as civilians by night and systematically wiping out all, not only leftist, but liberal, democratic, even middle-of-the-road centrist opposition to these various fascist governments in El Salvador and Guatemala, and et cetera.
All non-fascists, in other words, are prey to the death squads. Okay, now, in the first broadcast that we talked about on, the first of the 4 episodes of The Guns of November, we relied very heavily on the work of a man named Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty, last name P-R-O-U-T-Y. Now, Prouty was something known as, is known as Air Force Focal Point Officer. What this meant, he was a colonel in the Air Force, was that he basically was the liaison man between, the chief liaison man between the Pentagon and the CIA with regard to all CIA covert operations requiring the use of Air Force units or Air Force technology, okay? He was the chief liaison man, in other words, between the Air Force and the CIA for any CIA operations needing airplanes. And Prouty's one of the acknowledged experts on the covert U.S. intelligence establishment, and in his very famous and excellent book called The Secret Team, subtitled The CIA and Its Allies in Control of the World, he makes an excellent point in a discussion of the American military. Now, of course, anybody even remotely familiar with American society and its underpinnings is aware of the fact that according to the framers of the Constitution, the American military was to have a civilian commander-in-chief, in other words, the president. And basically, in wartime, the military was to take over with regard to the direction of the course of hostilities. After that, all control over affairs was to belong to the civilian section of our government. Now, in his book, The Secret Team, Prouty comes up with a couple of interesting observations. First of all, he notes the fact that basically the military, during the so-called Cold War period, the military switched from becoming strictly a wartime apparatus. In other words, during peacetime, it prepares for war and it only takes over during wartime, but that there was a subtle change of role for the military in the post-war period, that gradually not only did the military become basically a determiner of policy, and it began to perform the executive function with regard to foreign policy, but more importantly, he talks about something called nation building. Now, this is an interesting concept because he talks about the switching of roles from having the military attempt to stop communism in countries where it already existed, but through conventional armed means, the role switched, and Prouty identifies the switch in the late 50s, early 60s, to the notion of nation building. In other words, preventing communism from ever coming to countries that were not communist to begin with. And this concept of nation building basically entails the military reshaping that society in accordance with American anti-communist doctrine. And perhaps the single most important point he makes in connection with nation building is that the national security apparatus of the United States, in other words, the military and intelligence services, not only have they been engaged in nation building in other countries, but that the same elements which were used for nation building in other countries have then been brought back to the United States, where, again, they serve as nation builders. In other words, their nation building has gone on in American civilian society just as it has abroad.
In other words, we are the nation that has been built. And again, just to bring you back to the present a little bit, because we're going to be touching on a variety of things that happened in the past, if you want to keep in mind what these types of things, a very small and perhaps trivial example just took place during the invasion of Grenada, in which the press, which was completely barred for the first time in American history from covering a U.S. military action, was told by the State Department, which is the branch of the executive government, which is nominally in charge of American military, was told, sorry, the military's in charge and they make those decisions. We're also talking about an administration that not only has turned over all control to the military and these types of things, which is not supposed to be the military's purview, but we're also talking about a government where Ronald Reagan's, all his closest advisors are ex-military intelligence. And this is also a rather frightening fact, because, as has often been asserted, there is some doubt if there is such a thing as an ex-intelligence officer.
Okay, now, the presence of all of these Nazi elements in the assassination of President Kennedy and the manner in which the Nazis came to power in Germany, in other words, through a wave of assassinations of democratic elements, suggests to us an analogy, and we're just offering it forward for your examination here, that basically one could construct a rather haunting parallel between the formation of the Nazi Party, which, remember, was simply a vehicle for the introduction of the German army into civilian life for, if you will, nation building, and basically the dual role that the American military nation builders, quote-unquote, have been fulfilling in the United States. Now, we have not got the time this evening to go into all of the other assassinations, the full versions of all of the other assassinations. So basically, the assassinations of Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and the attempted assassination of George Wallace, the assassination of Malcolm X, these are all, basically analogous to the assassination of President Kennedy. The official versions of all of these crimes are not only wrong, they are physically impossible in a number of important respects. We haven't got the time to go into all of that for you tonight, but again, as I said, we... The kind of programming you're hearing now is typical of the kind of programming you're going to hear on this station, so we can pursue it in weeks to come. This is not an end, but a beginning. But unfortunately, we haven't got the time to go into all of the particulars concerning the various other assassinations now, or there'll be no phone-ins at the end of the session. So if you have any questions about this, you know, give us a call and we'll go into more detail. We just haven't got time to go into it now.
Okay, now, the thing we're going to be talking about first is the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. Not so much, again, as Dave said, the assassination itself, but on the nation-building factors and connections to the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy and some other things of that nature. Let me just mention real quickly that the entire public was convinced for a long time that this was the one incontestable assassination verdict by the, you know, by the powers that be, because after all, everybody had seen Sirhan Sirhan shoot at Robert Kennedy. Well, again, not to go into any details particularly, but several factors have been uncovered rather quickly, actually, and stomped on equally quickly as to some questions about that. For one thing, the coroner's report directly refuted any possibility of Sirhan Sirhan being the actual assassin of Robert F. Kennedy. He was definitely in the room. He was definitely firing a gun. But as to the fact of whether he actually put the fatal bullet into Robert Kennedy, Senator Robert Kennedy, who had just won the California primary, the coroner's report scotches that out. Absolutely. Also, there is a long history in the Robert F. Kennedy assassination of the special unit senator and the Los Angeles Police Department, the investigative arms at work in this case, literally destroying evidence contrary to the Sirhan is lone nut theory, and a variety of things else of this nature that, again, we don't really have time to go into tonight, but we can entertain calls in or we can talk about on some other venue here on KFJC. One of the strange aspects of the case, which later opened up a lot of these other areas for investigation, was the conduct of a man named Jerry Owen. Again, just to touch on him briefly, just to give you an introduction to what we're talking about, Jerry Owen was a man with a kind of a strange history. He began as a boxer, became an evangelical priest, had contacts very strongly in various right-wing political organizations and politico-religious organizations, was an acquaintance of Mayor Sam Yorty of Los Angeles, although this was not revealed to anybody until after the assassination itself and after Jerry Owen became integrally involved. Anyway, before Jerry Owen became very involved in the assassination. Now, Jerry Owen might not have ever come to anybody's attention except for the fact that he ran in to the Los Angeles Police Department, to a Los Angeles Police Department, a few days after the assassination, and claimed that he had given a ride to Sirhan Sirhan in his pickup truck, and that he was afraid that he might come to harm because of having seen Sirhan Sirhan in the company of some mysterious other characters, and being a witness to that fact. Well, the LAPD claimed that they interviewed Jerry Owen and that he had nothing to offer and that the whole thing seemed to be sort of a red herring, and threw his case out of court.
Yeah, in other words, they said that basically Owen was fabricating the whole thing, that he never picked up Sirhan, and that basically it was a bunch of hot air from a notorious windbag. Now, later on, it developed that fingerprints were taken on the pickup truck Owen was driving, which he borrowed from a guy named Bill Powers, and Sirhan's fingerprints were indeed in the pickup, and a whole network of witnesses had established probable contact between Owen and Sirhan before. In particular, Powers noted Owen had come driving up, Owen had previously had to borrow $50 to get hay to feed his horses at his ranch, and he drove up in a brand new Cadillac with a man looking very much like Sirhan Sirhan a few days before the killing, and flashed a thick roll of $100 bills, and a lot of other questions have developed around Jerry Owen.
Anyway, Owen, again, is a complicated case. It's covered in very good detail in the book we're going to be quoting from, and that I urge you to check out. You can find it anywhere. You can buy it or you can get it in the library. But one of the key things is that Jerry Owen's run into the police station to float this story appears, as one investigates the case, to be a situation of Jerry Owen trying to point the case in a certain direction for some reason which has not yet been fully ascertained. However, the two gentlemen who wrote the book, William Turner, who we quoted from earlier, who wrote Power on the Right, a former FBI agent and a former political candidate here in the Bay Area, and John Christian, that's J-O-N-N, John Christian, both of whom began to investigate the story through a court case that Jerry Owen had with radio station KCOP, or not through. The focus of their book was on the court case where Jerry Owen was removed from the air. His evangelical program was removed from the air because of the allegations that he was had a criminal record and might be involved in the Kennedy assassination. So Jerry Owen took radio TV station KCOP to court, and Christian and William Turner and later Vincent Bugliosi began to try to use this venue as a chance to explore some of the facts of the Robert F. Kennedy assassination. Anyway, we don't have too much time to go into it in depth.
Now, keep in mind here, you're going to be hearing about something, two very quick points before going back to Nip here. Two very quick points. You're going to hear about something called SUS, or Special Unit Senator. That was to the Robert Kennedy assassination, basically what the Warren Commission was to the John Kennedy assassination. In other words, that was the official body charged with investigating the crime, and in fact, instead of investigating it, they covered it up. SUS was the special LAPD unit set up for the Bobby Kennedy assassination. Now, keep in mind, you're going to hear a name called Dan Mitrione, last name Mitrione. Now, he's a fairly well-known fellow in the studies of U.S. intelligence operations, basically under the U.S. Office of Public Safety. A number of U.S. policemen were sent abroad in connection with the Agency for International Development and the Office of Public Safety to basically train foreign police in, basically espionage methods, anti-communist methods, and Mitrione in particular, as along with many others, was in charge with instructing them in techniques of interrogation by torture. Dan Mitrione was an American torture specialist who was in charge with teaching his methods and other communications methods and other police methods to police forces of various other countries in order to prevent communism from coming to these countries. In other words, this Mitrione and his fellows were part of the nation-building program that Prouty talks about.
Okay. Yeah, just to mention also that the Dan Mitrione case and Dan Mitrione's eventual death is the subject of the movie State of Siege by Costa Gavras, which is quite a well-known movie that you can catch it at some of the local movie theaters that play second or third run movies. A very good movie. And also documented in a book called Hidden Terrors, written by A.J. Langeth, LANGGUTH. Anyway, reading here from The Assassination of Robert F. Kennedy by John Christian and William Turner, we're going to talk about a couple of gentlemen, Pena and Fernandez, who were selected.
Hernandez,
I'm sorry, who were selected by Special Unit Senator and the LAPD to engage in some of the investigative work of the Special Unit Senators and LAPD's investigation of the Robert Kennedy assassination.
These two men actually headed Special Unit Senator. The two men, the actual nominal head was a guy named Robert Houghton, but these men were in charge of the actual day-to-day course of the investigation.
They ramrodded the team. Anyway, reading from The Assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. The choice of Lieutenant Manuel Pena, or Peña, for the key slot in SUS was a curious one. Among members of the force and the Mexican-American community, Peña was a living legend. Reputedly, he had killed 11 suspects, quote, in the line of duty, more than any other officer in the history of the department. In Special Unit Senator, that's the name of the book, Houghton described him as a, quote, stocky, intense, proud man of Mexican-American descent, with 22 years of experience under his belt at the time. Houghton boasted that Peña had commanded detective divisions, supervised a bank robbery squad, and, quote, spoke French and Spanish, and had connections with various intelligence agencies in several countries, unquote. What we, that's the authors, Christian and Turner, what we did not know at the time was that Peña and Hernandez interrogated Jerry Owen. Oh, excuse me, I'm sorry, that's still unclear. What we did not know at the time that Peña and Hernandez interrogated Jerry Owen was that both had long-standing connections with the CIA. Our first clue about Peña came months later, when a faded newspaper article came to our attention. On November 13, 1967, more than 6 months before the Robert F. Kennedy slaying, the San Fernando Valley Times had reported Peña's formal retirement from the LAPD. A surprise testimonial dinner was held in his honor at the Sportsman's Lodge, with LAPD Chief Tom Redden, prominent among the law enforcement fraternity, in attendance. It was a, quote, rousing and emotion-packed affair, the article said, and then quoted Redden, quote, I have known Manny for many years. I would have not missed being here for anything. The article revealed, quote, Peña retired from the police force to advance his career. He has accepted a position with the Agency for International Development Office of the State Department. As a public safety advisor, he will train and advise foreign police forces in investigative and administrative matters. After 9 weeks of training and orientation, he will be assigned to his post, possibly a Latin American country, judging by the fact that he speaks Spanish fluently, unquote. It is an open secret, write the authors, that the Office of Public Safety of the AID, Agency for International Development, has long served as a cover for the CIA's clandestine program of supplying advisors and instructors for national police and intelligence services in Southeast Asia and Latin America, engaged in anti-communist operations. In 1968, California Chief Deputy Attorney General Charles A. O'Brien informed us that this ultra-secret CIA unit was known to insiders as, quote, the Department of Dirty Tricks, and that one of its specialities was teaching foreign, quote, intelligence apparatus the techniques of assassination.